Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. I thank you for joining us. It's a holiday here in London where we tape this podcast. So I'm extremely grateful to the people who came in to join me, namely the people whose families don't like them, which is why they're here with us today. That would be Julian Lawrence and the former Crystal Palace, Ipswich Town, and Leicester City striker James Scowcroft, who's just regaled me with an anecdote about how he escaped a horde of rabid Millwall fans. So Scoey's unusual in that he's one of those professional footballers who actually enjoyed watching football and enjoyed paying to go to football matches. In other words, he's kind of like a normal human being. When he was playing for Palace, what does he do on his day off? He says, "Ooh, I know, I'll go watch Millwall because I enjoy watching football." Is that right so far?
It's not the full story. I went to watch Millwall Leicester, my former team.
While you were playing for Crystal Palace.
I was out injured and Crystal Palace were away. So I had treatment on a Saturday morning. But this is the story. Went to watch Millwall. I knew quite a few of the Leicester backroom staff. So I went to watch Millwall Leicester, which was in Division 1 at the time. Top of the table clash. Big game, which Leicester won 1-0. They got promotion that season.
Get to the interesting part.
Well, the interesting part came at half time when I was in the toilet where a Millwall fan came up to me. And
wait, you were telling me that you were in the stands. You don't even go to that special box for players from the courtesy box. You're in with the schlubs.
No, I was in the main stand. And at half time, a Millwall fan came up to me and just politely asked what I was doing there.
Did he use any foul language? Was he aggressive?
Yeah, a little bit. I can't repeat that. And I thought,
how do I get out of this situation? Was he bigger than you?
No, he wasn't bigger, but there was
four. Yeah, loads of friends.
There's four of them.
And this is what you won't, in the press box and in the director's box, you won't see this, but I was washing my hands, actually. And what are you doing here? I'm signing for you next week on loan. Oh, great. Well, my Millwall is...
Waited a few... So basically, you lied to a bunch of Millwall fans.
There was a little bit of a rumour. Kenny Jackett was half interested at the time, but it never really quite come on.
Okay, so if you're one of those Millwall fans who confronted Scowcroft, who feel disappointed, please do get in touch with us, and maybe we can organise a reunion. Anyway, what a massive digression. Later on, we're going to be looking ahead to the Champions League and this week's quarterfinals. But there's one place to start in the Premier League at Stamford Bridge. Julian, we thought there might be a race for the top four now that Spurs have beaten Chelsea 3-1. We don't have one anymore, do we?
That's over, I think. The only race would be for third, I would think. But I'm afraid for Chelsea, Arsenal, to a lesser degree, it's over. And in fairness, I think the top four right now, which will be the top four at the end of the season, are the four best teams in the country, the four best teams this season. So
is there anything you're excited about other than relegation?
Not really.
All right. Roll on the Champions League then. Scully, we'll get to the far-reaching implications, but I want to ask you, technically, because Christian Eriksen, I thought, scored a tremendous goal. I know some people criticized the goalkeeper, Willy Caballero, who was in for the injured Courtois. I don't know. What struck me, and I was there, I saw it in real time, was just how he seemed to hit the ball so hard, and it dipped so well. Can you just describe technically how you do that?
Well, it's a new technique that's sort of come into football, and a few people are sort of doing it now, where you actually strike the ball with the instep of your foot, which is very difficult. It's a very difficult skill. It's one that takes hours of practice on the training ground, but people have always, from that distance, just, you know, put the laces through the ball and hope for the best. But you do get a lot more control of the ball if you're side-footing, and if you can get the power... And the way you sort of come over and hit the top of the ball, you will get dip as well. And Ericsson's a master. He's done it before, so it's not a one-off, a fluke. And if you get it right, like he did yesterday, it looks very, very good. It's a superb bit of skill technique.
It's like a tennis player hitting with top
spin.
Yeah,
exactly. You've given a better description than me. That's exactly what he's done from that range as well to get that kind of power. Takes a lot of strength in your leg, really.
Now, Conte came out afterwards and said that actually they dominated the first half. Could have been 2-0 up at halftime. Obviously, Eriksen's goal kind of came out of nothing, although you wonder, you kind of know that this guy can shoot from distance. Maybe you should have shut him down a little bit sooner. And then in the second half, Chelsea had the urgency of needing to win the game, and they get caught out by that very good ball and really good run from Dier to Dele Alli. Is it as simple as that? Or is he just making excuses, Scully?
I think he's making excuses. If we look in the Times this morning, there's a great aerial picture of the goal. Nobody's anywhere near Eric Dier. And the back three, it's almost a back four at the time, is so high up. It's almost, say, put it in there. You know, it's a nice little run, but there's space to run in there. Someone's got to close Dier down. Very, very similar to Ericsson's goal as well. We can say that's a good goal, but... A player of his ability to come in 25 yards from goal and nobody get anywhere near that, I think that's, as much as what it is good play, it's poor play by Chelsea. And I think that starts from the manager as well there, where you have to, in a game like that, you have to play with a high tempo and shut good players down.
I'll put my Conte hat on. Okay, that's nice for you, but I only have one Conte. The other guy I have out there is Cesc Fabregas, and in the second half of games, it's crazy to expect him to do that. So I'm better off having Dier, let's let Dier have it. Gab, how often is Dier going to hit that ball?
Gab, if you look at...
And maybe if Caballero comes off his line, or if Azpilicueta comes across sooner, and maybe if Dele Alli doesn't kill the ball with a perfect touch, then maybe they don't score.
There's two counter-arguments against that. If he does find that much, you drop off. So you think to yourself, we're going to give ourselves 5 or 6 yards here. So if anyone does make a run, we've got time to adjust and clear the play. Also, the area the pitch is in, one of your centre forwards can close him down quite easily. I understand that the midfield, it's very hard for them to push
out. You only have one centre forward, and it's Morata.
We'll get him to close the ball down then.
What was he supposed to do? Close down Dier, close down Vertonghen, and close down Sanchez at the same time?
Oh, no, go and close down Dier. Make him play it out to wide or play it back to... It's simple.
I just think Fabregas can play in a game of this importance in a two with Conte. I mean, we've talked about Pogba's positioning all season. Fabregas, for me, is impossible to play in that position. And Conte, on his own, can't compete, can't cope with Dier and Dembele. And Fabregas can't defend. Fabregas can't run anymore in the way that a centre midfielder should run in a game like this. And you've got Bakayoko and Drinkwater. I'm not saying that Chelsea would have won with either of them. I'm just saying that they are naturally more defensively minded, especially Drinkwater, than Fabregas. And I don't understand why Fabregas started that game.
Well, I think he started that game because they needed to win, and because Bakayoko's not right physically and maybe not right in the head. And
yeah.
Was dry. Actually,
Drinkwater's on the bench, unused. I just don't know. I know you have to win, but you also can't lose it. And you can't get exposed the way they do on the first Ali goal, for example, which is clearly because there's a point where Conte can't press everyone and Fabregas didn't do any pressing at all.
So the issue now, let's talk a bit about what happens to the Chelsea manager. I think the generally accepted narrative right now is that writing is obviously more than on the wall. But even before that, you know, for a long time, I think back in October, somebody wrote that, you know, either way, Conte's gone. You know, either he wins the league or the Champions League and says, all right, my work here is done, or he doesn't, and he gets moved on. He still has an FA Cup to play for, and he still says that, you know, he's clinging on to hope of finishing top four, but it'll be very, very difficult. What do Chelsea do next?
Because obviously the director of football, Michael Imanalo, departed during the holidays. Do you sign a director of football first?
Is that linked with...
Do you have time to do that?
Is that linked with who you appoint as a manager?
Well, I would assume...
Can you do one before the other or two at the same time? Or the two, or you sign a director of football who then helps you sign the right manager?
That's what I would do. I mean, I think there are certain basic rules here, right? You don't want to sign a director of football who's comes as a package with the manager. If you have a good director of football, he helps you make an informed choice in signing the manager. And then, of course, part of his job is acting as a buffer with Marina and whatever else. But, you know, that's part of the job. I'm just wondering, I mean, we're in April now. Is it too late to bring in a director of football? Because if you drop in a director of football and a manager at the same time, you know, it's, and both are getting used to it.
Does Marina want... director of football? That's the thing. He looked for a long time that Imanalo and Marina, was that really working? And then if you, on top of that, you had a manager who wants his word into the whole transfer.
It's funny.
It looked like that. There was three in that marriage and it never really worked out.
It's funny. People say, like, is it really working? And I go back to this. In the last 10 years, Chelsea won 3 league titles. They won a Champions League. They won a Europa League. They won various odd cups, domestic cups here in England. They did it while respecting financial fair play and while changing managers. And it kind of always worked.
Yeah, but Imanalo was not there for the whole 10 years. When he was there, how much did he really do and how much Marina Granovskaya did, for example? Did Imanalo really had any sort of influence?
Don't go 10 years. Go back to 2011.
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so in what? In 7 years, they won 2 league titles, a Champions League, a Europa League, and an array of cups. I mean, who's won more? City,
yeah,
that's
you
it.
Lose your sporting director or director of football, whatever you want to call it, in Imanalo, surely if you want another one, you replace him quicker than what happened this season, no?
That's the part which I find really odd and maybe where they really screwed up. Because I'm sure Michael Imanalo didn't wake up one morning. In fact, I know he didn't wake up one morning in December and be like, oh... You know what? I think I'm going to move to the south of France and, you know, and just leave. Like, I'm sure he gave them a fair amount of advance notice. He went to Monaco where there's Vadim Vasilyev, who, of course, is tight with a proprietor at Chelsea. To me, it seems like this is a major dropping of the ball. Maybe they had another target who then for whatever reason, didn't pan out. If you don't have time to sign a director of football, if you go with a manager... The names that have been mentioned, it's funny because it's actually been pretty quiet, right? I don't know what names you guys have seen in the press, but I've seen Luis Enrique. I've seen Brendan Rodgers.
Thomas Tuchel.
But it's funny, though. It's pretty indicative, right? So of those three, let's leave Rodgers to one side for a minute because obviously he was at the club before. But, man, Luis Enrique and Thomas Tuchel, without a buffer director of football... I don't think that's a good idea. I mean, brilliant managers, especially Tuchel. But
do you know that the old director of football was in charge of signing the players, or it was higher up? It was Roman in charge of doing it.
Yes, I can tell you. No, he was not. Yeah, he's been very much disengaged in terms of putting in and giving advice and listening to agents who give him advice. He's not. It was Michael Imanalo working with a manager. Sometimes get the first.
It's scouting and looking at players, etc. It's impossible for one person to do it. There must be. Chelsea would have a very, very good network of established people working in areas that I'm still is still in place now. Is it just somebody that comes in? Well, exactly. So what I'm saying is, if that's all in place, if the infrastructure's all in place. Do they really need someone to come in straight away and, oh my God, we can't survive without somebody at the top pulling the strings?
Well, I think the director of football basically does two things, right? He helps sign the players and identify the players, figure out how they fit. And look, we're talking about identifying players, right? When you're at Chelsea's level or United's level, you're not...
The world being smaller now, you don't need a guru to say... The lad Mbappe's good in France. I've spotted this player.
That's precisely the point I was going to make. Right? So it becomes more of how does this player fit, right? Chelsea aren't going to they're not going to sign unknowns for the first team, exactly. Right? But by the same token, you'd be surprised, managers, even at that level, and I can probably share anecdotes off the air here, from Mourinho to Pochettino to Conte, they're all focused on their team. They don't, they have no idea what happens elsewhere. They know about the guys they play against, yeah. Right? No, but they know.
I totally get it.
You know, so that's a big part of the role.
Yeah.
But the other big part, specifically at Chelsea, and it depends on the personality of the manager. If you have Carlo Ancelotti, it's less of an issue. If you have a guy like Luis Enrique or Tuchel, you need a buffer between them and Marina. And that was a role that Michael Emanalo did. You don't necessarily want a direct line to the most powerful person at the club. It's not healthy. And I think, you know, and I think that's something to consider. And bear in mind, too, this is a different situation. I mean, Mourinho could do it on his own because he's personable when he wants to be and whatever else, and he's doing this a long time. Neither Luis Enrique nor Tuchel are that kind of person. Hypothetically, do we think it's going to be one of those three?
Yes.
Yes.
Out of those three, who would be the worst possible choice?
Brendan Rodgers, every day.
Okay, I know you don't like Brendan.
I think Brendan Rodgers would be a good fit. I think he knows the league well, he knows the club well. I think that would be, probably knows the dynamics of the football club. I think Brendan Rodgers would be a good shout.
I don't think so.
Why don't you like Brendan Rodgers as Chelsea manager?
Just, I don't know.
He wants him to go to Arsenal.
I'm not impressed at all by what I've seen. I just don't think...
Look at the Celtic teams, they run away with the league every year.
You would win the league as Celtic manager.
Now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial. And in addition to those videos, you get our excellent content, which I, for one, really value. Oh, and before I ask you what your favorite goal is, if you don't... All right, we've already discussed Eriksen. I'm assuming one of you guys will mention that. There's another obvious candidate for me, and I will ask about it personally if neither of you guys mention it. But Scully, who's your guy?
I've actually given it to Dele Alli. His first goal, his run, his touch is fantastic. I actually think his second touch, where he scores past Cameron, is fantastic. The way he controls it there, the composure. He's got a millisecond to sort of react and everything. He gets everything right from the touch to the run. Everything is perfect. I think it's a fantastic goal. He deserves a lot of credit. He looks at the ball the whole time it leaves, so he doesn't have any time to look or actually realise where the goal is. So the timing of his second touch is fantastic.
Julian?
I thought far too long about this. I thought about Ashley Barnes' goal.
That would have been my goal.
For a big guy like him.
Given we've talked the Eriksen.
Just reactive, just hooks it in over his shoulder. Man.
I went for the Gabriel Jesus' goal. For Man City against Everton, so City's second goal. Not for the finish because I don't think it's a good header. Not for the cross from De Bruyne because I think any player in the Premier League can make that cross. It's not a hard cross. The Leroy Sané's role in the goal because I think his touch is amazing. His control of the ball is amazing. The way he humiliates Phil Jagielka. I mean, I know Phil Jagielka gets humiliated a lot this season, but still, with that sombrero over him and then the pass to De Bruyne, I think is amazing. There's 11 seconds between the pass from Edison on the goal kick to Gabriel Jesus' header, which I think is amazing. And for City's brilliance this season with the ball and all the possession, all the pattern of passes, all the style of football, for them to score a goal on transition like this in 11 seconds, in literally 1, 2, 3 passes, I think is fantastic.
Scobie's looking physically sick with your description of City. But by the way, I love Leroy. So I wish it was... He wouldn't be my player of the season because there's better candidates, but goodness me. Like, if you want to talk upside, upward arc, the guy's a mismatch. Everton and City. I know possession stats are, you know, people say, oh, what do they mean? And they tell you a little bit how the game went. When a visiting team gets 82.1% possession and they're 3-0 up at halftime, I think above all what it tells you is that nothing the home side are doing works, right? Because they've conceded 3 goals. And I'm not sure how you can give up so much of the ball at home. How is that possible? It's like a combination of being incapable of keeping the ball, of taking any kind of sting or momentum out of the opposition, and a serious difficulty as well in winning it back.
Running after shadows, it looked in that first half especially... but also in the second half. And it looks like giving up as well. Like they gave up very quickly. I mean, playing Wayne Rooney, you know how much I don't really like Sam Allardyce, obviously. How on earth do you think that you're playing at home against City? City, who, by the way, haven't played for 3 weeks, went on a lads' break in Dubai, so they will be as fresh as hell. And you think, yeah, Wayne Rooney, yeah, let's play him in a, you know, in a two in midfield with Morgan Schneiderlin, because Wayne Rooney is going to run after David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne.
I like Sam Allardyce a lot more than you do. I give him, you know. And I'm trying to wrap my head around what was he trying to do, because so you're playing with two very attacking fullbacks who don't do much defending, and Leighton Baines and Seamus Coleman. Schneiderlin's your holding. It's almost like he's like, I mean, I looked at this as, is he trying to mirror them? People list City as 4-3-3. I think of it more as a 4-1-4-1, right? Is he trying to kind of do the same thing where, you know, Rooney's impersonating De Bruyne and Dominic Calvert-Lewin is David Silva?
I'll stop you right now. It was a two in midfield. And he expected, what did he expect? What was the thought?
You're a United fan. You had Wayne Rooney posters up in your room when you were an adult. and playing against him. Does it hurt you to see him playing like this, in this position?
First, it doesn't make any sense, right?
It doesn't. I saw him in his last two seasons at Manchester United, and it was painful to watch him. Possibly the best player I've seen live, but his legs are gone, you know, and it was clear. And I think he's had a bit of an Indian summer at Everton, which was always going to happen, but... You know, you're right, to play him against the quality of Man City in midfield, you're playing with 10 men. And I feel sorry for Rooney with that.
Lineup he put out, though, right? So maybe he was trying to surprise them somehow?
But if you're going to put an attacking lineup, you need to... I saw Crystal Palace play Man City, and I've seen Liverpool do it, and I've seen Crystal Palace, and both of them have had success when they've done it, and that is squeeze up the pitch. When Edison, the goalkeeper, gets it. Everybody gets a man. They squeeze down everything. And Crystal Palace should have beat them.
Sorry, you say squeeze up the pitch, right? This is my problem with squeezing up the pitch. And I go back to Leroy Sané. When you have Sané and Sterling, who can just outrun everything, and you have Ederson, who can just boot it wherever he wants, right, okay. It's really difficult to do.
No. Jesus' goal is that. Right, they squeeze it on that goal.
So my argument would be...
Okay. Sign Usain Bolt and put him at the back.
No, squeeze up the pitch. Man for man, we're going to press down on every single player. Who's going to put Sané in and Sterling in? Who's going to play the ball in?
Well, you can press as much as you want, but all it takes is a man clearance.
Answer the question: who is going to get the ball to play these players in? The worst thing you can do is let them have the first pass and then press, because what you'll do, you'll leave spaces where you've vacated. But if you go down and you say, right, here's my man, go and stand on his toes and see how good he is in possession. Crystal Palace, miles, they should have won. And I thought Ryerson was excellent the way he set up against Man City. Liverpool have done it as well. If you go and you push right down on it, all of a sudden life becomes a lot harder for these players.
They also find space and they get out of the high press.
But you have to be a pressing team to do that, which Everton don't have the players to do that.
That's a very good point. That's exactly what you have to do. But listen, you haven't done that and you're 3-0 down at half time, so it hasn't worked what you've done.
I mean, Julian, you're a neutral here. Do you think that neutrals are going to say, you know what, we don't want City just to turn the rest of the league into procession? Do you think this is actually one situation where all the ABUs actually turn into United fans for one weekend?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of people will say, oh, we don't want like a Ligue 1 with PSG dominating, and we don't want a Juve, Serie A, blah, blah, blah. It's not good for the Premier League.
And as competitive as what the Premier League is, it almost happens every year where one team... runs away. It's not many times but Chelsea strolled it last year. Leicester to a certain point won it by, did they win it by 10 points in the end?
Yeah, but that's because it was Spurs.
But also it was never, and it's, they never dominated the whole season like this, you know, with like one defeat. And
okay, so the consensus seems to be that everybody, all the ABUs will be,
you'll have those hipsters who say like City played like no one has ever played before in this league, and you know it's amazing, and they're going to break the...
I have a feeling we're going to have that debate next week, and people will get angry. How can you say they're the greatest team ever? Yeah, whatever. Sam Allardyce, would you sack him at the end of the season?
It's a difficult one, isn't it, for Everton?
Why? What's making it difficult? Tell me.
I I see what's making it difficult, right? There's only so many times, Julian, you can throw the dice, if you understand what I'm saying. There's only so many times you think, right, we've gone out and spent 150, 200 million, however much they've spent, not got it right. They've then had to get Allardyce in to correct it and make sure they're stable. There's only so many times you can do that before you actually have to hold your hands up and you become a Mike Ashley at Everton and think, we've run out of money. You can't keep saying, right, we'll bring a new manager in, we'll bring Silver in from Watford. Yeah, here's another 150 million going to spend.
Here's the thing. Why do you have to then spend another 150 million? It's not like that's going to be Allardyce's.
If you think someone with this squad of players is going to totally transform them and they're going
to... This is what gets me, and I've made this point before, right? You go to Marco Silva or Eddie Howe or Sean Dyche and you say, listen, we have this group of players here, okay? Some of them were bought by Koeman, some of them were bought by Walsh, some of them were bought by Allardyce. We think that this is the seventh best squad in the Premier League, okay? Now, we're pretty confident that if we keep Big Sam, we'll finish seventh or eighth because that's the value of the squad. Do you believe you're a better manager? Can you do a better job with this group of players? And maybe we can sign one or two guys, okay? But that has to be the starting point. It can't be like, oh, look, you're coming in here. Oh, let's go and spend another 200 million. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
So what you're saying is you think another manager can come in and get an extra 10 points a season, 15 points a season?
If a manager doesn't convince me that he can do that, then I keep Allardyce. I'm pretty sure that Marco Silva believes that he could get an extra 10 points if he has a full season working with these people. I'm pretty sure Eddie Howe probably believes that too. We can debate whether he's right or wrong. I mean, if you went to Sean Dyche and you said, look, can you do a better job with these players than Big Sam has done? What do you think Sean Dyche is going to say? No, actually, I'm not going to Big Sam. Now, come on.
Everton, as we sit today, are ninth in the table. I think their squad is around about a mid-table squad.
But the point has to be, we can't just go into this thing for granted. We'll change managers, spend money. The game has moved on from that. That's not how it works anymore.
Really?
No, it works like that with crappy, badly run clubs. Well, with bad owners and shifty managers who go in and think that they can finagle more money. You're a manager, manage. Right? I mean...
Everton are ninth. I think Allardyce has had some terrible games, terrible mistakes. His communication has been dreadful. I think, and I know a few Everton season ticket holders, they don't want him there. Most of the fans don't want him there. You know, he keeps finding excuses, silly lines like, oh, I'm going to watch television tonight, it's going to be better than what I've seen today. I just think the whole thing has been a car crash. And okay, they're ninth, and they're better than when you took them over. But I don't think that was hard with the squad. They were never going to go down anyway. I don't know. I think the football has been dire for most of his time at the club this season.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Love the game? Then don't miss The Game Daily. It's your lunchtime update from football's finest writers, and it's only at thetimes.co.uk. And as we tape this, we have some breaking news, thanks to our producer, Charlie. Alan Pardew is no longer the West Brom manager. I mean, frankly, I'm shocked after 17 games and defeats in a row. Basically, these guys at West Brom, they've sacked the chief executive, the chairman, and now the manager. obviously they're going to go down, they're going to rebuild. We have reports that an old mate of yours, Darren Moore, is now the West Brom manager. Do you have any idea what he's like as a manager, if he's ever managed before? Or do you want to just tell us what he was, how much fun it was to play against him?
He was horrible to play against, Gab. A real wholehearted guy, strong as an ox. Really nice lad, actually. Pleased for him. He's been around the coaching scene for a while, done all his coaching stuff. So deserves a chance, and he's got 6 games in the Premier League to get good experience under his belt. I think they could do a lot worse than probably follow on with him into the Championship next year. So,
do we know anything about the way he wants to play? Or
no, and I don't think he will be totally decided yet. I think he's a good footballing person that knows a game very, very well, knows West Brom very well as well. So it's a sensible choice. Possibly the club should have done it a while ago to maybe give someone a fighting chance, but it's over for them now.
Postmortem on Pardew.
Don't come to me on that, because I'll slaughter him forever.
Next Everton manager.
Who? We've talked about it on the pod before. There's no way Alan Pardew is good enough anymore for a Premier League club. I'm sorry. I don't know the guy. I've got nothing against him. I'm just talking on what I see on the pitch. He's won like, what, 7 games out of 62 of his last 62 in the Premier League. I think he's just... That's just not good enough. First, how he was appointed in the first place at West Brom is beyond me. How he stayed so long after being so bad at West Brom is beyond me.
One game out of 18.
Yeah, and I think if you take those previous seasons as well, I think it's like 7 or 8 in 60. This is, it's just not, I mean, come on.
Scott, are we going to see him again? What makes Pardew a good manager?
Look, he's got experience. You can't, whatever you do in life, the more experience you get, it obviously helps you. You cannot say the job that he inherited was an easy job, to replace Tony Pulis and try and turn that around, and you know, players that were Tony Pulis' disciples, basically, I think was a very tough job. I think he needs to have a break. I don't think we'll see him back in the Premier League, but certainly in the Championship we'll see him.
Would you want him back at your old club, Palace?
The Ipswich job's up.
Would you want him at Ipswich?
I would say Ipswich could do a lot worse.
Really? Who'd be worse than Alan Pardew?
I think you're being very harsh.
No. I mean, I'm telling you.
We've had this debate, us three. Was it 2 years ago when he was at Crystal Palace? And it ended up in... I actually defended it, and it ended up me getting a phone call from the owner at Crystal Palace.
And what happened?
Did the owners end up sacking Pardew?
Exactly, because he was dreadful there already.
So you think Ipswich is more likely?
No, I don't think so, but I think we'll see.
Does he have any ties to Ipswich?
No. But I think we'll see him in the Championship. I think he'd do well for a good team in the Championship. He's got bags of experience. The people that I know that have played under him say he's a fantastic coach. And that's from some really good guys that I respect in the game.
But you reckon he needs a break now? So yeah, probably not. Yeah. Not straight back.
Look, all these guys that are floating around the bottom half, it's extremely tough. You know, going into Southampton, turning that around at the moment is tough. West Ham's a tough job. Crystal Palace is a tough job. Stoke, you know, it's... All these people do it, and they can't all be bad people that get sacked.
No. Well, I mean, look, I think more generally, right, we say Crystal Palace is such a tough job, right? They had what I think is totally overmatched, really bad manager who lost a bunch of games. He left. They brought in a guy who's experienced and who, not everybody's cup of tea, but generally a good person and a good manager. And hey, look, they're out of the relegation zone. I mean, if you take the start of the season out of it, I suppose Palace would probably be close to mid table, right?
12 or 13, yeah.
So, this idea that it's so tough, it's so impossible. Huddersfield, right? You have a team that barely came up. You have a manager who's a bit curious. They're staying up. I mean, they're not staying up definitely, but right now they're not in the relegation zone.
Is Newcastle a better squad than West Brom? I'm not so sure.
Okay, but that's different. There you have a very good manager.
Yeah, but exactly. That's
so,
the difference.
But this idea that it's so impossible, I don't.
But that's the difference he makes. Having a good manager.
Okay.
I'm saying if it's possible. Let's look at the Premier League. You've got the top five now that battle out for the league and the Champions League. Arsenal are going to be in six forever whilst they carry on. You're then going to get a Burnley who's going to have a super season, finish where they are. There's always one club. You probably get a club like Leicester that's well run. Well, the rest of it are fighting relegation. And it's all right to say, oh, yeah, but for the first seven games, if happened...
But the point is, some teams are doing it while playing well and showing a plan and sticking to it. And, I mean, look, if Brighton go down, which is possible, right, or Huddersfield go down, I don't think anybody's going to say, like, oh, look, what a rubbish job Chris Hughton and David Wagner did, right? Nobody's going to go and blame them.
Because it's their first year in the Premier League, so it's a bit of a give-me, isn't it? Anything, if you stay up, you've done a wonderful job. If next year someone takes them down, all of a sudden, oh, what a terrible job.
All right, talk Champions League. It's a quarter-final stage. It's Liverpool and City, Barcelona and Roma, Sevilla and Bayern, and Juventus and Real Madrid. Let's do this in inverse order. Barcelona and Roma, Julian, foregone conclusion? Or are Barcelona a little too Messi-dependent right now?
That photo at the weekend on Saturday was amazing when he was a Serb, he's warming up on the touchline, Sevilla's just scored the second, they're 2-0 up and they're celebrating in front of him, and you could see him looking at them and thinking, like, just wait, that come on. And then he came on, obviously. And
they nearly scored a third, yeah, too, Sevilla, yeah, which is remarkable.
I would like Roma to put up a fight, and I think, you know, I'm hoping that Eusebio Di Francesco will have a plan in place. I think they've been great in the Champions League this season. I do think that the fitness of some key players, it might be an issue. I mean, we saw Nainggolan coming off at the weekend on Saturday. You know, they clearly had their mind on that Barca game already, because that was not a very good performance from Roma, although there was a lot of changes. But yeah, it looks on paper that it's going to be tough.
When I made the point that Barcelona are maybe a little bit more Messi dependent this year, I had a whole reaction. People were like, no, you don't understand Valverde. We're just more of a defensive team this year. We've got the best defense in the world, and Umtiti and Pique and blah, blah, blah. Now, I saw them at the weekend. Umtiti and Pique were not good at all. Now, I know they've been good for most of the season, but it strikes me that when Busquets isn't there, and I think he's a doubt for the Roma game, I mean, Rakitic you can't expect him to do what Busquets does. I mean, there's probably nobody in the world.
At the weekend. Either. Paulinho at the weekend either. And I think it was the same a bit for Spain without Busquets.
People, yeah, they only scored 6 against Argentina.
No, but you see what I mean. People underestimate what a great job he does. Not just on the ball, because people, you know, see the passing range is incredible. But just protecting that back four, and especially those two there in Umtiti and Piqué. And by the way, Umtiti was dreadful with France. So he's had 3 games in a row where it was really, really, yeah, it's a tough time for him.
Sevilla and Bayern, Skola, you got to see Sevilla up close. Mourinho, of course, talked about how so many of these Sevilla players would get into the United team. If they have all these players who are good enough to get into the United team, and United are second in table in the Premier League, then it stands to reason that they have more than a fighting chance against Bayern, right?
No, I have to disagree with that. I think Bayern Munich will actually be adventurous and get into Sevilla's half and probably take the game to them. I think Seville at home, the atmosphere was fantastic, the game I saw. Certainly,
if
they
Bayern get a 0-0 draw in Seville, is that a great result? sorry, no, I'm going to stop.
That is bad,
God. Stop.
And he can support Chelsea next year in Romania on a Thursday night.
Oh, nice one.
I just think Bayern will be too strong for Seville.
The thing about Bayern is, my concern, I kind of got the sense that this is sort of, you know, a lot of fool's gold since January, in the sense that they haven't played great, I thought, in the Bundesliga. They had a number of close calls. Jupp Heynckes seems to be, he just keeps talking about retirement and blah, 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 and going on holiday. This continuous rotation of the team, it seems to be designed to, like, keep everybody happy. And I thought, you know what, maybe when they play a real team, they'll run into trouble. And I thought maybe it's going to be Borussia Dortmund.
I thought so too.
Yeah, and then what happened?
It's
23 minutes,
game.
It's 3-0 up.
It's a practice game. They look like they were training.
It's like, okay, yeah. Guys, like
4-2, 5-2.
Juventus and Real Madrid, this on paper should be close. It's a rematch of the final. But then you realize that Benacia and Pjanic are out, suspended for the first leg. You're making a face. Does this mean that it's kind of foregone conclusion?
It's not. And again, I think Allegri, I think the battle between the two managers is going to be quite fascinating over the two legs.
They both have so many tactical permutations and so many insecurities that they can do.
True. But it's a game that you want everybody to be fit. You want both teams to feel their strongest team.
But the thing with Zidane is it's kind of difficult to see. So with Zidane, for the longest time, it was 4-3-3, right?
Yeah.
And BBC.
Yeah.
The problem with that is, if you do that, you've got Ronaldo and Bale out there, and you know you're going to have opposing fullbacks just blowing past them like they're not there. They've had more success when they've gone with a 4-4-2-4, 4-4-2, whatever you want to call it, playing the wingers. There's the Isco factor, who's you know who's arguably the most creative player in Spain. And could we imagine him dropping one of the central midfielders to try to maybe play Ronaldo with Benzema up front, and then you can get Bale and Asensio, or Isco and Asensio, or Isco and Bale, or
I've got a feeling that he's going to go back to the Isco factor of last year that worked so well for him in the Champions League. Drop Bale, have Isco in that free role, and set to Isco
and keep the three central midfielders.
Yeah, and then set to Isco, and then you've got Lucas Vazquez and Asensio on the bench that can come on like they did against PSG in the first leg, for example, and just turn the game. If it's not working with Isco, can you imagine all the options he has? The guy, it's incredible. Okay, you play Isco first as a free number 10 behind Ronaldo and Benzema. Wow. That's not working? Okay, you got Gareth Bale who can come on. Wow. That's not working? Yeah. You can have Asensio coming on. It's just incredible.
By the way, he missed 2 months of the season. He's 14 goals this year. I think his production's picking up as well. Yeah. Scully, Liverpool and City giving you support. I'm assuming you might be figuring out for a way for them both to lose. That's not going to happen. But to a layman, you got two managers who press, who attack, high energy. Oh, look, this is going to finish 6-5. It really works out that way, though, does it?
No, it doesn't, no. But I think it will be a close tie. I don't think it's a great tie for Man City. I think about all the quarterfinals. I don't think it's a great... I just think being an English side. Liverpool, they haven't got one up on Man City this year, but they're the team that have...
Well, they beat Man City.
Yeah, but... Okay, they beat Man City, but they're 50 points in front of them, aren't they? So it's, you know... But I think it's a very difficult game for Man City. And I think with Liverpool up their game in the Champions League, yeah, they've won it five times. I think out of all of those teams, the one team that can cause Man City the biggest problems are Liverpool.
How do you do... Right, so to me... This boils down to one big existential question for Klopp. Do you change the way you play? Did you tweak it? And how do you tweak it? And I'm thinking primarily Trent Alexander-Arnold up against a pacey winger. That seems to be one obvious thing. Do you play Henderson and Sean together in midfield to maybe try to get a little more oomph in there? Or do you just say, you know what? Let's just go toe-to-toe. Let them worry about us. Let's unleash Genie and Oxlade-Chamberlain and the front three. You know, because after all, you know, we've got Salah and Mane and Bobby Firmino.
The one problem,
he just went over his head. Yeah, but
listen, the one problem that Liverpool have got is the first game being at home. If they are a little bit too full on, a bit too expansive, try and they get picked off, the game could be over.
Right, enough of that. How about some quick hits instead? Liverpool win at Crystal Palace and Mohamed Salah scores. Same old, but Scorey, I want to ask you about Benteke misfiring. On Match of the Day, they pointed out that he missed 22 big chances this season, which is Opta's way of counting opportunities that you really should bury. Now, you were a centre forward once. Did you ever waste as many chances as this? And Is Hodgson right not to be concerned, or is it just something he has to say? I mean, how do you do? I know you're going to say you got to regain your confidence, you got to keep trying, but is there anything?
Well, it's a problem for Crystal Palace because they've got the squad, they've got the fixtures to stay up and to not be into trouble, to get themselves out of trouble and not being. But when your main centre forward is missing chances, he is at the moment, that is a huge concern. Now, Roy Hodgson can't come out and say it's a big problem, blah, 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 because the zero confidence that Benteke's got at the moment just diminishes.
Do you think it's a confidence? Because people massive, always massive. Bring this
if you look at...
Different people have different personalities. Yeah. Some guys just keep... Cristiano Ronaldo had a big drought, for example, right?
Yeah.
I don't think nobody questions his confidence, right? No. Just keep shooting.
Yeah.
Do we know that Benteke is like that?
Yeah, definitely. And I think if you look at Benteke's in the Premier League, at Aston Villa and Liverpool, his record is good. You know, he's always been a good goal scorer. I don't think Crystal Palace play to Benteke's strengths. I don't think they get the ball in the box enough in the air. I don't think they've the service he gets is as good as what it should be. But it's a problem, and it's a problem that they need to solve quickly, Crystal Palace, because it could hinder them, I think.
Arsenal roll over Stoke 3-0 with the help of a controversial penalty. But Julian, I want to ask you about Aubameyang giving up his chance at a hat-trick by letting Alexander Lacazette take a penalty. Tony Cascarino suggests it might indicate a lack of ruthlessness by Aubameyang. He's your rival. You must crush him. What say you?
Really? No, really? What's wrong with people? What's wrong with Aubameyang giving the pen to his mate Lacazette, who hasn't played for a long time? He's a bit down in confidence because, you know, he saw his mate coming in and taking his place. What's wrong with that?
Why are they mates? They've never played together.
When Aubameyang was at Saint-Etienne and Lacazette at Lyon, they were friends from there.
How are they friends? Lyon and Saint-Etienne are supposed to be the big derby rivalry.
They live next to each other.
This is my problem with French football.
You can still be... What do you mean French football? Surely you could have Laziale and Roma players being friends, like you can have City and United players.
Do you think Peter Reid and McMahon were friends?
I know many City players friends with United players, that's for sure.
Yeah,
come on.
Foreigners.
So please, let's stop the cynical aspect of, oh, Aubameyang should have taken a hat-trick. I think it was a great gesture from him to do that.
I agree with you, actually. Manchester United cruise to a 2-0 win over Swansea, and Romelu Lukaku gets his 100th goal. Paul Pogba, funny enough, played well too, continuing from his fine performance during the international break. Scoey, we've turned a corner here. Mourinho was right all along. There's no issue there. Remember, Pogba even came over to high-five Mourinho. It's just fake news by the MSM once again, right?
I think coming over to high-five your manager just proves there's a problem between the two of them.
There's no problem. You really believe that?
No, I think Mourinho digs his players out. I think he gets on their backs. Some will say that's management ship. I've seen Pogba be unplayable, and I've seen Pogba be awful. I think he needs consistency in the game. I think he needs to settle down. Next season's a big season for him. No, they haven't turned a corner.
It's been good, 2 games in a row. Give him time. Speaking of United, after the game, Mourinho called in Carlos Carvajal, the Swansea manager, and said he deserves to be manager of the year. Julian, is it just being mischievous? I mean, we all agree Carvajal's done a great job. They were in the relegation zone. Now they're not. But you know what? That applies to other people, like, say, Roy Hodgson as well. Is he just being mischievous and either trolling the gravelly-voiced ginger one or the bald guy down the road?
Yellow ribbon one. Yeah. I think it was a bit of that. It was funny in many ways. It was very much Jose's, you know, own show and all of that. But I think the best bit was when Carlos Carvajal came onto the stage with a press conference and tapped Mourinho on the shoulder and said, "My assistant," which I thought was really funny.
Who'd be more fun on a night out?
Oh, Carlos. Sure.
Carlos Carvajal or Justin
Carlos
Mourinho?
Looks really
Who'd you rather hang out with? Carvajal or Mourinho?
I wouldn't mind having an evening with Mourinho.
Depends on the objective of your night out. Bournemouth grab a late equaliser at Watford thanks to, who else? Jermaine Defoe. He scores the big goals. That's why they paid the big money for him. His big contract. Apparently Defoe then suggested, and I don't know if he was joking or not, that he could come on and score a World Cup winner for England. Scott, do you want to offer a reality check here?
Well, he's not going to be in the England squad, is he? So that's reality. It won't be happening. Could he
come on?
What's
more realistic? What's more likely to happen? Defoe in the England squad? England winning the World Cup? Or Defoe scoring during the World Cup?
Well, Defoe's not going to be in the squad, so that's two of the questions gone. England winning the World Cup, I don't think they will do, but I think they'll go further than people think.
Is that more likely than...
The best line was he said, you know, I would come on and win the World Cup. And then he went, it's as simple as that. No, Jermaine, it's not simple at all.
No, but he's obviously joking, right?
He's not. If you know Jermaine Defoe, he's not joking. No, I believe he can still do a job at that level.
Now, there's plenty of fretting over West Ham and the supporters and the unholy trinity, and the visit to Southampton potentially could have been really, really nasty for them. But it turned into a great performance at a fun and easy win with Mark Arnautovic stealing the show. João Mário even playing very, very well. Arnautovic having a go at Sparky, who he evidently doesn't really like. Julian, see, they're going to be just fine.
You told me. It must be hard to be a West Ham fan because you just don't know what's going to happen with your team, you know. And
I loved Moyes' reaction on the touchline. Good for him.
And you see, you bench Patrice Evra and suddenly your team is playing quite well. So Arnautovic as a centre forward in those kind of games, I think is brilliant. It doesn't work in every game, but in certain games, I think he'd be brilliant.
He's the poor man's Ibra.
Gab, one for you. So many big games around Europe and around the world this weekend. Sum them up for us in 30 seconds, if you can.
Yes, as we mentioned, Bayern going absolutely pound stuffing out of Borussia Dortmund. So much for Der Klassiker. They have a million-point lead over Schalke. Juventus back against the wall at home against AC Milan. It was 1-1. It looked like we'd have the title race was reopening. Didn't happen. Juve did what Juve do, and they rolled to a 3-1 win. Barcelona away to Seville, 2-0 down. Hey, no problem. Messi comes on, and he turns the game, ends up 2-2. In France, Paris Saint-Germain against Monaco in the prestigious French League Cup. Yes, there is such a thing. They win 2-0. And Zlatan Ibrahimovic. How about that? You can read. There's an excellent column about him in the game today. Maybe how he can have a bigger impact on MLS than one David Joseph Beckham. 20 minutes to go. It's the LA Derby, which they call El Tráfico, against the newly formed LAFC. Comes on, scores with his first touch from a million miles out. When we were talking before, Scully said he also scored a similar goal years ago in a preseason game. And then, of course, he scores a winner in injury time on a cross, which might have been offside, by Ashley Cole. No, Ashley Cole hasn't retired. He's still playing professional football. In fact, I think he captains the LA Galaxy. So, quite a Saturday for us. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guests, James Scowcroft and Julian Lawrence. Remember, just £8 gets you an 8-week trial of our newspaper, The Times. And you also get that other newspaper, The Sunday Times. Just search The Times online. In addition to our content, you also get highlights of every single game in the Premier League, the Champions League, the Europa League, and the FA Cup. It's a pretty sweet deal, methinks. We're going to be back next Monday after what could be the title decider, but some of us hope won't be. It's the Manchester Derby.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.